Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Fleet Navigator podcast, your go-to GPS for all fleet matters. I'm Matthew Walters, Head of Consultancy Services for LeasePlan. I'm joined today by my colleague Dom Sirlis. Hi Dom, how you doing?
Very well, thanks Matt. But that's probably enough about us. Let's crack on with some discussion about the autumn statement, shall we?
Quite right. So yes, you're right. That's about enough about the two of us. Let's talk about something that really matters. It's been a few days since Jeremy Hunt delivered his second autumn statement, and that's given us time to take on board everything that he announced. What's your take on it, Dom?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all chancellors have to respond to events to some extent, but Jeremy Hunt has had to be rather more responsive than most. From conflicts to the cost of living.
Yeah, and not to mention some fairly awful polling figures barely a year out from the next general election.
Yeah, yeah. He needs to do a lot more than simply announce the current state of play.
Yeah, it's a good point. Before we get into what was said and what wasn't, it's worth having a quick reminder about what the autumn statement is meant to be. The purpose of the autumn statement is to give the public an update about the government's plan for the economy. It is based on the Office of Budget Responsibility's latest economic and fiscal forecasts. While the budget has the detail about taxation and what the government is doing. However, that description of the autumn statement is pretty loose, certainly loose enough that it can be used to do a lot more if the Chancellor wants to. We saw that last year, and this year was no different.
Yeah, and the minute you get into detail like that, you're looking at much more than just a simple update. It's something that can affect the take-home pay and household budgets of millions of people, as well as setting out how much will be spent on key public services. So, having stressed just how important this could be, what was the economic backdrop behind the Chancellor's announcements?
Well, from the OBR's perspective, it feels like we're looking at a game of two halves, really. The public finances are in better shape than the OBR previously expected, but it also thinks the economy will grow significantly more slowly than it previously forecast.
And it's the same for inflation as well. While it's well down on its high of 11.1% last year, at just 4.6% in October, that's still more than double the Bank of England's target, 2%.
And to get to that point, interest rates have soared, which has made borrowing a lot more expensive, affecting business and personal spending, and therefore the economy. My view is that we're at or as close to the top for interest rates, and we should start seeing interest rate cuts sometime next year. Hopefully sooner rather than later, but realistically, probably sometime in the summer. That said, this assumes there aren't any major surprises, which seems a dangerous thing to say in a decade that has had quite a few of them.
The job market isn't looking great either, with unemployment slowly rising and some forecasts suggesting it will peak at 5.1% sometime next year. But there is a health warning there because the ONS hasn't been able to complete the labour force survey recently, so the statistics are a little bit more vague than we're used to.
Yeah, so it's an interesting point. And then, of course, finally, there's the standard of living. Or, to put it in a more tangible way, how much we have in our pockets for spending and saving. The bad news there is that the OBR thinks real household disposable income will still be below 2019 levels in 2028, mainly as a result of rising energy costs.
So that was the backdrop. It isn't a particularly bright one, and I don't envy the Chancellor for the decisions he had to make. Here's what they were.
So, starting from the bottom in the case of the Chancellor, because he left the best till last, the highlight for households was a cut in national insurance contributions combined with a rise in the living wage. Unfortunately, this good news, which it is, had a small sting in the tail for companies using salary sacrifice to make electric cars more affordable. A higher living wage means some employees won't be eligible for salary sacrifice anymore, as the reduction in their salaries to cover the vehicle payments would take them below the threshold. Plus, there weren't any changes to Class 1A employer contributions, so there are no extra savings that companies can pass on through salary sacrifice.
Continuing the theme of good news, but not for car drivers, we have the Chancellor's decision to make the super deduction permanent. A 100% capital allowance can really help companies make long-term investment plans around plant and machinery, from forklifts and tractors to vans and trucks. But cars are exempt from the scheme, as are vehicles that are bought with the intention to be leased. We spent the best part of this year in a working group with other leading names in the industry, plus the BVRLA, trying to get this changed. Reforms are really needed, particularly if the government wants to hit its electric vehicle registration targets, but there's no news yet.
So, stepping back from the autumn statement for a second, I'd also like to highlight the government's plan for drivers, which was announced in October. This included numerous measures to support motorists, including new traffic light technology, a national parking platform, grants for cross-pavement charging solutions, and a myth-busting campaign for EVs. I'm all for anything that makes life easier for drivers, but it's worth noting the autumn statement didn't address the question marks about funding. Hopefully this is something that will be covered in the spring budget.
There was a lot more than just this announced, of course. From changes in benefits and how they're claimed, to a higher state pension, a higher local housing allowance, new investment in manufacturing, and the creation of new investment zones. Plus, changes to self-employment taxation and a business rates discount for the hospitality, retail and leisure sectors. But from our point of view, I'm afraid we've reached the point where we talk about what wasn't announced, and there's quite a bit.
So, up first, there's the need for additional support for the electric van market. Not only is the business case not as clear-cut for these vehicles as it is for cars, the regulations around the largest electric vans need fixing. Battery weight means these vans are treated as HGVs, with all the extra rules that implies. But their diesel equivalents aren't. If the problems aren't solved soon, we could end up with a situation where flatline electric van sales force OEMs to cut back on new diesel vans to avoid fines. Nobody wins if that happens.
Then there's the cost of public charging. With high energy prices, these charges work out at almost 20 pence per mile. A diesel car or van only has to achieve 37 miles per gallon to break even. Of course, it's good news that the 5 pence cut in fuel duty will last until next March, as it's helping to manage inflation and provides breathing space for companies and individuals who rely on their vehicles. But with the drive to electrification, why wouldn't they want to offer some encouragement to electric vehicles too? Plus, there's at least one solution that's very straightforward, and they know all about it as the industry's been lobbying hard for it. All they have to do is cut the VAT rate on public charging from 20% to the same 5% paid for domestic energy.
On the charging front, it's also disappointing that there was no additional funding announced to grow the public charging network. Yes, it's getting larger as it is, but the rate of growth is nowhere near fast enough. An analysis by the Times earlier this year suggested the government was going to miss its 2030 target of 300,000 new charging points.
Not just by a little bit, but by 20 years. Mandatory zero emission sales targets start next year, so urgent action really is needed.
And on top of everything else, if nothing changes, electric cars are set to get more expensive in April 2025, as the road tax exemption for electric cars and reduction for hybrids will end. Plus, the expensive car supplement will apply to new EVs from that point. We had hoped that this might be addressed in the statement, but there's still time for this one to be sorted out. Though, given that the VED system for vans has remained the same for 5 years after the government launched a consultation, it's by no means a sure thing.
I guess that's really the theme of this autumn statement. For everything that was announced, there's a lot more that we'd hoped to hear, but didn't. We'll continue all our work with the government in the coming months, and hopefully we'll have better news in our budget special next year.
Plus, of course, we will, as always, have tips and guidance to help you look after your fleet during this difficult time.
We hope you found this Fleet Navigator helpful. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me as well. Thanks, Dom. Look forward to speaking to you next time.